All right, thank you very much. I want to thank organizers for giving me this opportunity to talk here. So I want to start with a very general problem, which perhaps comes up in every scientific discipline. And the problem goes somewhat like this. So we have a particular phenomenon which we don't know anything about, but which we're interested in, and we want to study it. So generally what happens, we do an experiment, and we get some data, right? So since, of course, our world is not perfect, our data is quite noisy. And then we want to do an analysis of that data to make a particular hypothesis. So things like once we make a hypothesis, you know, analyze, okay, we have a particular hypothesis. If it turns out to be true, there's several things we can do. If it's a very nice hypothesis, we can kind of go here, make a lot of money, do something like that. Or we can try to make other hypotheses about the phenomenon and do another experiment to test whether they're true or not and keep studying that thing. So now, what I'm interested in is using topology and geometry to perform this part of this pipeline. So, and topological data analysis in particular is kind of goes somewhat like this. It's a very crude description, but we want to capture topological and geometric information of data somehow, and we want to capture it using some nice descriptors in some sense. I'm gonna be more precise a bit later. And so I'm going to call those descriptors topological summaries, and I just use this symbol to denote them. So then once you compute those descriptors, which in some sense would capture the topological properties of your data, you want to use them to make a particular type of inference about your data. And again, I'm going to make these things more precise. So this is kind of a very general setup of the problem. But now I want to now go into a bit more concrete problem, which turned out to be actually quite difficult. So suppose now this is a toy. I'm going to use a toy example to illustrate this problem. And so suppose we have just a simple circle. That's our kind of data, and that's the underlying space. And our data comes from a Gaussian distribution around this circle. So it's kind of corrupted by noise like this, right? So that's what we observe, the observable data. And suppose you use whatever the methods you have to compute that magical thing, that topological summary that you have. And when you compute it, you know, each of these topological summaries can tell you that there's a one cycle in here, there's this loop, right? Each of them tells you that. But at the same time, each of these guys is different, right? And then the question becomes, well, so can we say something about like the average case? Can we say that, you know, on average, there is some kind of a cycle in there? And moreover, can we then quantify the uncertainty? That's more important. How can we quantify the uncertainty of this topological feature? So in a sense, how do we define the mean of these guys and the variance? That's the question, right? So it turned out to be a very difficult question, how to do it rigorously. So now what I want to do, I want to kind of introduce these things more precisely, what I mean by topological summary and so on. So let me start with a typical setup that we have. So we will assume that our data is somehow embedded as a point set in a high-dimensional Euclidean space. That's a typical setup. And what you can do, you can associate to this point cloud a special function. And not always, but usually, it's useful to use just a distance function to that particular point set. And here's an example. Suppose our unknown underlying space is something like this. We sample it, we get this point cloud. Right? So now, when you use a distance function, what we look then is, we look at the sublevel sets of this function. So we want to see how the sets in which a function takes a particular value, how they change. So in this, if you have a distance function, the good thing is, and you heard it already yesterday, the sublevel sets are just kind of unions of balls, and that's very easy, you know. So we look at how these unions of balls change their topology as we progress, as we increase the value of the function. And you can see that it kind of changes interestingly. There's a lot of artifacts, and then at some point we might get the true topology, but we might actually miss it sometimes, right? So there's never a unique scale which it can be the case that there's never a unique scale which gives you the right topology. You always get a wrong topology, but if you look at all of them somehow through all of the scales, you might actually capture the right topology. That was the underlying idea of topological persistence, you know. And so let me make it a little bit more precise. So if you look at these guys here, right? This is a set of spaces, and I just picked a few levels in here. You can see that here's what happens. At first, we don't have the right topology at all. then all of a sudden we get a bunch of things. So all these connected components, right, they disappear as we increase the value. But at the same time, there's a bunch of other things, in particular seven one cycles are born. I actually did count them, so there's seven. But what happens is that some of those cycles, they die as you move on, but some of them don't, and some other get born and die. But the important thing is that there's one particular one cycle which you get in here, which is persistent in the sense that it lives for a long time. The idea was to capture somehow that information so that we can see which of those topological features live for a long time and which don't. That was the idea of topological persistence, and it turns out you can do it very rigorously. You can define how all those things work. So what would be the topological summary in this case? How do we capture all this information about topology, you know, of the sublevel sets as we change the continuum number of those sublevel sets? Turns out that there's a nice way to do that. And it's called persistence diagrams. And there was a small introduction to persistence diagrams yesterday, very nice one. What I'm going to do is something very similar. And it's easier to illustrate this using a one-dimensional example rather than a two-dimensional example. So in this case, we just have a function which is a function on a circle. My circle is a nice compact space. And in this case, if we look at the sublevel sets, you know, we see, and the sublevel sets, well, are going to consist mainly just of connected components up to the very end. So it's only going to be interested in zero-dimensional homology in this case. And you can see that whenever we hit the minimum in here, right, something gets born. A particular feature, in this case a connected component, gets born. And there's more minima, and whenever we hit another minimum, another connected component gets born. Once you hit the maximum in here, so what happens is that this guy that was born here, right, this guy, it merges with another guy which was born before that. And therefore, you take this guy, which is younger, and you say, okay, this guy actually dies because the number of connected components decreased. So you say, okay, the younger guy dies, and you take the birth and the death of that connected component and use those as your x and y coordinates for a point, and you put that point on a plane. So your x-axis here is the birth, your y-axis here is the death of a topological feature, and you get a point telling you when a particular topological feature gets born and dies. And you keep doing that, and you get a bunch of points in this case. So what happens in this case, actually, once we hit this maximum, nothing dies. In fact, what happens, you get the whole circle, so actually a one cycle gets born. So zero-dimensional guys don't change. In a sense, you actually have this one connected component, which you created at the very at the absolute minimum, and it lives forever, so it's at infinity. But it's useful to actually, if you have a compact, nice compact space and a continuous function, so it's useful to kill off everything at the maximum, of the absolute maximum of the function. It's not necessary to do it that way. There's a notion of extended persistence which allows you not to do this, but it's actually quite convenient to do it this way. Because we do want to have persistence of every feature is finite. That's pretty much the idea here. And you will see later why exactly that is needed. So this is pretty much the idea. So you have maybe your data or something you associate to a particular function. Once you have your function, you compute this persistence diagram, and you can see you can compute it for every dimension. I mean, in here I capture zero-dimensional features, but it's possible to capture one-dimensional, two-dimensional, and so on. So you get your persistence diagram. And this is exactly the topological summary that I was talking about. That's what we're going to be interested in, right? So now the problem that I was talking about, let me make it even more concrete, right? So in this case, for each of these guys, I can compute a persistence diagram. Now, I just want to point out that I took the diagonal that I had before here, and I just pushed it down a little bit so that it looks a bit better. So, you know, this is 45 degrees, let's put it this way, but it looks better this way. But the idea here is that if you look at any of these diagrams, you see that you have a lot of noise, and noise is going to be kind of, those are features which have very small persistence, and, you know, those are typically called, like, topological noise. But there's one feature which kind of, it does stand out a lot, you see in here. This is one-dimensional persistence diagram, so they capture one-dimensional homology. So you see that, oh, there's one in here, one in here, and one in here. So yes, for any of these diagrams, you would say, like, hey, there's a one cycle there. That's exactly what I was talking before. But at the same time, they're all somewhat different. And the idea is, okay, so what is the persistence, the average persistence of that cycle when we, you know, sample like this? Can we somehow compute it, you know? So how do, and so now the question is, what is the mean of persistence diagrams, and what is the variance, you know, when we compute that mean? How do you do that? So fortunately, there's an additional structure to these persistence diagrams. Unfortunately, not very well, fine one, but still something. So it turns out that we can define a distance between persistence diagrams, and there are several ways to do that. A particular distance that I will use here is called, we call it Wasserstein distance, and it goes somewhat like this. So you have two diagrams here, right? So what you try to, for technical reasons, actually, you include the diagonal, you know, so include it as a part of the diagram. So why? Because what we're trying to do when we use the metrics here, we look at all possible bijections between two diagrams, and diagrams can have different number of points. But because you include the diagonal in here, you allow your points to be paired to the diagonal. So for any bijection between two diagrams, you allow points to be paired to the diagonal, and diagonal has infinite number of points. So in this case, for example, for these two functions in here, that actually you saw that picture yesterday as well. So the first one, the red one, has only two off-diagonal points. The blue one, which is a perturbation of the small of the red one, it has many more points, but you can see that most of them are very close to the diagonal. So what we are trying to do here, we look at all possible bijections between these guys, and for each bijection, you look at this distance between each pair of points, which are paired by these bijections, and you look at a L infinity in the plane distance between these two points. You sum those things up to the power p, and then in the end, you take 1 over p power. And what I forgot to put in here is an infinum, so there should be an infinum in here. For some reason, it's not there. Anyways, so you actually take infinum over all possible bijections. So in some sense, you find the optimal one, the one that says that if you sum all these small kind of segments in here, you know, the length of those, it will give you the smallest possible value. So that's going to be your Wasserstein distance. So it turns out that this distance is, in some sense, continuous. Because if you you can think of it as a map from you can think of a persistence diagram as a map from the space of functions to the space of persistence diagrams, and in that sense, you know, that map is going to be in this particular, if you use this distance, that map is going to be continuous, and this is has been proved by using this particular theorem, which tells you that if you have two functions such that the supernorm between these two functions is about something small, then the Wasserstein distance between the corresponding diagrams is also going to be small. And of course, modulo some details, and you know, which I'm not going to talk about because they're kind of technical. So this is the distance that we use. So we have a space of persistence diagrams. We have a distance on them. All right, so it is a metric space. Can we do some statistics or probability theory on this metric space? And there's a lot of theory that allows you to do that. The problem with this space, the way we defined it right now, is that, well, we use a finite number of points in our persistence diagrams. And if you use a finite number of points in your persistence diagrams, it turns out that the space is not a complete space. And this is just a small example here which illustrates that it's not a complete space. So what happens is that you can, in the limit, your sequence can turn out to have infinite number of points. So you can have a sequence which is a Cauchy sequence. It's all nice and dandy, but then in the limit, it turns out that the limit has infinite number of points, and our space, by definition, has finite number of points in each diagram. So, and you know that if you want to do a nice probability theory on metric space, you got to have completeness and also separability. You want to have a polished space. That's the idea. So what do you do in this case? Well, you pretty much take the completion of the space. That's the idea. You say, all right, so we get infinite number of points in the limit, so let's just allow our diagrams to have infinite number of points. And so we're going to have something like similar to an LP space, you know, space of sequences. So we will allow our diagrams to have infinite number of points, off-diagonal points in them, but such that if you look at a persistence of each point, which is the distance vertical horizontal to the diagonal, and you sum those things up to the power p, you say that if, so we're going to consider only diagrams where this sum is finite, is bounded, So we're gonna we will call this space DP. So this is our space of persistence diagrams. It is, if you think about it, it is kind of similar to your, you know, small LP space, except that, you know, we don't have sequences, we have diagrams of points. Now, well, and here's the main theorem. Well, actually, no, this is not the main one, but it's almost the main one. This space, DP, turns out to be complete and separable. And the proof of this fact turned out to be much more difficult than I thought it would be. At first, I thought that I just can take the idea of, you know, proving completeness of LP space and can use it, and it doesn't really translate that well because we don't have a notion of pointwise convergence because our metric allows for all kind of, you know, possible permutations of points. So we don't have it. So this difficulty, we tried to resolve it using something which we called persistence-wise convergence. So the idea was very simple. It's say, like, all right, we have a diagram, like, let's say sequence of diagrams. So what we can look at the part of it where points have persistence at least alpha, right? So for each diagram, you throw out all the points which have persistence strictly less than alpha, and you're left with this part of the diagram. So you know that this part will always have a finite number of points, and then you say, okay, if I can prove convergence just for these parts of my diagrams, right, for your sequence, for each diagram you take this part, and then if you prove that those things converge to something, and then you say, okay, maybe we can take a limit when alpha tends to zero, and we can prove some convergence as well, and, you know, completeness that well. So it's all nice, but it doesn't really work that well, because it turns out that you can have this kind of convergence from below. So you can have a sequence of diagrams such that, you know, each diagram can have a point, you know, below the threshold alpha, but then in the limit, this point will turn out to have actually persistence alpha. So that can happen. So that kind of complicates things as well. But, you know, there's one fact which allows you to deal with this kind of difficulty. And the fact is that if you take any Cauchy sequence in this space, it turns out that points kind of separate after a while. So after a while, it doesn't matter which region above the diagonal you pick, it will happen that, you know, there will be points which will be always epsilon close to your alpha, if this is your threshold alpha, and then points which are kind of far away from that threshold. So you will have this region where there's nothing going to be there, right? So they separate. So you can use this and, you know, a bunch of technical ideas to prove actually that, yes, so you have a Cauchy sequence, it will converge in this space and everything is nice. Well, and separability actually turned out to be quite simple using rational coordinates on the plane. So that was the fact, and it's like, all right, so we proved it's nice and complete, so let's try to do some probability theory to prove some, you know, define mean and variance. So, and if you, you know, read up on probability theory on metric spaces, you'll see that very often they use a notion of a Fréchet mean. And a Fréchet mean is defined using, well, this kind of integral. So if you have a probability space, so suppose you have, we have our DP and we have some probability measure on it, right, on this metric space. Then, so what you can do for each fixed point, D, you can look at the squared distance to D, and you can integrate that squared distance over all points in your space, and you get a particular value. And then what you're trying to do, you try to minimize whatever value you take. So you try to find a point such that it minimizes this integral. So it's you take infinitum over all points in your space. So this value itself is called Fréchet variance. If the set of points where this infinitum is attained is called a Fréchet mean. Now, the idea for this guy actually comes from the fact that if you consider a Hilbert space, so in the Hilbert space, this thing will coincide with a regularly defined mean and, you know, variance. So, but the problem with this general definition is that the Fréchet mean can be empty. Because this, if you think about it, like, if I'm looking for this infinitum, suppose I have a sequence of values which tend to this infinitum, but the sequence of points which give me that value, that infinitum, can kind of run away to infinity or run away somewhere else outside of my space. It will not necessarily converge. So how could we prove that, that was the question, how can we prove that it will not actually be empty under some maybe assumptions in their probability measure, right? So if you think about it a little bit, you'll see that, oh, if we understand compactness in the space DP, then probably we can answer the question. Why? Because if our space were compact to begin with, then, well, obviously this would not be empty, right? That's obvious. So, well, then the idea is if we can somehow characterize compactness in the space, maybe we can figure out, you know, which assumptions we need and so on. Well, that's exactly what we did. So, of course, for compactness, we need boundedness. That's a well-known fact. But what if we do have boundedness? What else can go wrong in this weird space of persistence diagrams? Well, here's one thing that can go wrong. You can have, think of each point in here as a separate persistence diagram which has just one point in it, right? So, and so this is like our nth persistence diagram. It has this point on it. The next one is, you know, has the point here. The next one has the point here. So you see that all this sequence is a bounded sequence because each of these points is epsilon away, let's say, from the diagonal, right? So all of these diagrams are going to be epsilon away from the empty diagram. Empty meaning having just the diagonal. It doesn't have any off-diagonal points. So it's bounded, but at the same time, the points kind of run away to infinity. You know, you can show very easily that this sequence doesn't have a Cauchy subsequence. It will not converge in this space. So that's what happens. So that's the first thing that can go wrong. We call these bad things not off-diagonally birth-death bounded, and if they are, we call them off-diagonally birth-death bounded. And the idea is that whenever we have, so we want to have a set such as that whenever we have these things where this birth and death goes away to infinity, they also have to converge to the diagonal in some sense. That's the idea. So that those kind of sets we're going to call off-diagonally birth-death bounded. Another thing that can go wrong is slightly different. So think about it. Again, each point in here is a separate diagram, but now this single point has multiplicity 2 to the power n. So think about it this way. So it's like 2 to the power n points in the same location. So in every time you decrease the persistence of this point by 2 to the power n, by 2, but you increase the multiplicity as well. So every time the total persistence of each of these the total persistence for each diagram stays the same all the time, but the points themselves, the persistence actually tends to infinity, right? So in some sense, you have this mass, the fixed mass accumulating somehow closer and closer to infinity. You have this accumulation of mass which goes on. So this is bad, and so we call these bad things non-uniform. If they're not bad, we call them uniform. So for uniform, so we shall call, let's say, a set of diagrams uniform if they satisfy this kind of interesting condition. If we cut out something, you know, if we cut out a region close to the diagonal, so if we throw out everything, every point to the diagonal, so for each diagram, whatever is very close to the diagonal, it's a persistence, total persistence has to decrease as we kind of imagine this region around the diagonal with some diameter, right? And as we decrease this diameter of that region around the diagonal, the total persistence of any diagram in my set, the total persistence of those points which are close to the diagonal, it should go down. It should decrease to zero. That's the idea. It cannot stay constant as it does in this case. So the good thing, it turns out that these are the only two bad things that can happen. And this is the theorem that tells you that. So we will have relative compactness whenever we have a bounded, off-diagonally bounded, and a birth-death bounded, and uniform set. That was the theorem. Well, once we understood this, we managed to prove the theorem, which tells you that if you do have a probability measure on this space with a compact support, then you can show that the Frechet mean is not gonna, Frechet expectation is not going to be empty. So that was very nice. And then we said, well, what if we don't have a probability measure with a compact support? What if support is not compact? And if you think about it, if it kind of decays fast enough outside of a compact set, it should still be good enough. Well, and that's exactly what happens. These are just technical conditions, but and you can read them if you want. But the idea is that, indeed, if your probability measure is such that outside of a compact set, it decays fast enough, and there's a race of decaying here and stuff like that, but then you will still have a non-empty Frechet mean. That's the idea. So you can. There's a lot of technical things in there which I'm kind of not covering, but that's the basic idea is that. All right, so it turns out that once we got all this stuff, so yes, we have a notion of a mean now of persistence diagrams. So we have base and variance as well. So we have basic building blocks which could allow us to do statistics hopefully on with persistence diagrams with topology. So and I just want to illustrate a simple example here. So I'm going to show you what we probably could do in theory. So if we have, suppose we have a torus and a double torus, and we know that we have, let's say, a set of, in this case, persistence diagrams, which we have computed for some samples of a torus, and now we have persistence diagrams for samples of a double torus. And then we get another persistence diagram, but we don't know if it is from a torus or a double torus. And it turns out that you can do a statistical inference in this case, or you know, it's actually a classification problem and from machine learning. But what you can do now, you can set up these estimates of your density function on the space of persistence diagrams now. Of course, these normalizing constants, K, kappa, tau, are not known, but we will see that they're not needed. So tau in here is just the bandwidth parameter in the estimation of the density. So suppose we have some priors, probably uniform priors on our, you know, persistence diagrams. And then you can just compute posterior using the regular bias rule. And, you know, you can figure out using the posterior whether your Z belongs to a torus or double torus. So in some sense, it's just classical statistical thing, but we now use it to do statistical inference with the persistence diagrams. So that's kind of exciting. All right, so this is just a very first step in some sense into this kind of making of this statistical theory of persistence diagrams and topological data analysis rigorous. There's many questions, of course, and one of them is, well, how do we actually compute Frashini? It turns out that in theory it's possible to compute, I can tell you how one can compute it, but that algorithm will be not just exponential, it's horribly complex. I mean, complexity is like n to the power n or something like that. So the problem is that the space itself is not non-positively curved. So for non-positively curved spaces, you know, there's an algorithm that computes Frashen mean, and it's known that it's unique and so on, but it's not true in our case. And we don't really have a fast algorithm to compute Frashen mean of persistence diagrams. Well, also, it would be nice to have some convergence results saying that, you know, now if we have some, you know, persistence diagrams computed for samples of a particular distribution, then will they converge in what sense to a persistence diagrams corresponding to that distribution itself? You know, that's another result that would be useful in this case. And also, I talked about persistence diagrams, but there's some other topological summaries that are interested in particular read graphs. Can we do something like that in read graphs? Well, that's about it. I want to thank my collaborators and the, you know, support of these agencies, and here are some references. Thank you.